You may know Dixie Carter from her seven-year stint as the sassy Julia Sugarbaker on the hit series Designing Women. But as you can hear, Miss Dixie Carter has far more to her than brazen southern sauciness. If the nightly reruns on WPIX aren't enough of a fix, you can catch her through this Saturday at the Cafe Carlisle, and we're listening to her second album, Dixie Carter Sings John Wolowitz, live at the Carlisle. She just published the book, Trying to Get to Heaven, Opinions of a Tennessee Talker, for Simon & Schuster, and her first exercise video, Dixie Carter's Unworkout, went platinum. And that's not all. Well, I'm very grateful that Miss Carter could squeeze us into her busy schedule. Welcome to New York & Company.
Oh, thank you so much.
I don't imagine you have much time when performing at the Carlisle. It must be exhausting to perform two shows a night, ten shows a week.
Yep. It wears me out. I don't usually go. I just came out to see you today, special. I usually rest entirely on Sunday and Monday so that my voice will be fresh on Tuesday.
But this is really a return to your roots, isn't it?
I lived here for a long time.
But yes, also you started off doing soprano leads for the Front Street Theater, didn't you?
Oh, you mean singing?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I thought that I was destined to sing at the Met, though. When I was 4 years old, I told my parents I was going to sing at the Metropolitan Opera in New York City, which I thought was in the radio, because that was where I heard it, you know, on Saturday afternoons.
So still broadcasting them.
Yes, they are. God bless them. I didn't have the voice to sing Grand Opera, but now I'm singing just across town from the Met.
You know, you live in L.A., right?
Yes,
but you don't
do
cabaret there. Is there no cabaret scene in L.A.?
I don't care for the places in I love the Carlisle. I love just this one particular room. I stay at the hotel. Mm. I've always enjoyed, loved coming to see Bobby Short, singing at the Carlisle when I lived here before in another life, when I was married here and raising my little baby girls here. My idea of a sophisticated night out in New York City was to hear Bobby Short at the Carlisle. And I didn't dream, of course, those years ago that I'd get to sing there myself. So I wouldn't trade it for anything. And no, I don't perform in L.A. because people in L.A. are interested in getting up early the next morning and working out and worrying about how they look. So they're not going to be staying up late and carrying on.
Well, you also said that they're worried that their plastic surgery is going to flop in the middle
of
the night.
If they stay up too late.
Well, actually, there's no place like the Carlisle because the food is better than any other cabaret.
Well,
the place is more glamorous than any other cabaret.
It's so beautiful with the Erte drawings, the murals on the walls. So beautiful.
Do you need to sing? I mean, you do this because you still love it, right? It fulfills something
in
you?
Yes, I'm not doing it for the money. We can just put it that way. It's a great love of mine to sing and also to perform live. There are three ingredients in this way of performing. There's the material, then there's me, and then there's the audience, which is also why I did a play this summer out in Los Angeles. I do a play when I get a chance to, because I like to perform live. And television has earned me my living, you know, which is why I live in Los Angeles. But it's the audience that gives me the thrill.
How did you wind up hooking up with John Wolowitz, who used to be a regular on the show?
Well, I very often tell one story or another. I'm presenting John with Lynn Lavin and Bertram Ross, and I are part of a presentation moment tonight at the Edison Hotel. John's winning an award for his participation in the cabaret world. And for his gorgeous music that he writes. I'm doing four of his songs this year at the Carlisle. I met John in May of 1963 when I first arrived, almost 2 weeks to the day after I first arrived in New York City. He lived at the corner of 11th and 4th Street in the Village. And as I say in my show, you might imagine it was hard for a Tennessee girl to get it into her head that 4th and 11th Streets would cross one another. So I was late for our appointment, but once we met, we became friends and have been these more than 30 years now.
And you're still singing his songs.
And I'm still singing his songs.
A lot of people must take you to be Julia Sugarbaker.
Yes.
Is that an identification you're comfortable with?
Quite comfortable. What a wonderful woman she was.
Well, she could be a difficult
person. She and I are different in this. She could not stand to be wrong. But she taught me a lot. I'm a more conservative person politically than Julia, and she pulled me in her direction a little bit, and she taught me to speak up for myself. and I think I softened Julia as we went along. But I'll tell you another great advantage of having played that part. I'm known around the country now, in a way, certainly that I wasn't. And I'm known in a way that causes people who come to me in airports or on the street and speak to me to be very kind and very friendly. I'm not one of those people who've played characters that elicits another kind of response.
Well, you had a career before you got that role, although
yes,
you
I did
suggest
like
that
this.
You said that you might have called your book Sleeping Until 40.
Yes.
You know, you were working, but it was the big breakthrough occurred with the show.
With Designing Women, clearly. Mm-hmm. That was it.
So was it traumatic when they canceled the show after 7 years?
Yes. I cried and cried, but then we have to get over it. And they say 7 years is the cycle in life. And so now, that's something that was, as this was and is no more. I'm just grateful for it. I'm not sorry about it or sad or looking back longingly toward it anymore. I'm going forward, and one of these days, the networks are going to figure out that a television show that I would want to do would be quite popular, I believe. However, my criterion would have to be, which is why I'm not on now, I think, that the humor would have to derive from someplace other than the private parts of the human body or the act of going to the bathroom. And when you leave that out, you've left out most of the jokes you see on television right now.
Actually, Designing Women was one of the first of the sitcoms to have everybody saying witty things. Now that seems to be the norm. You can't even get a person who is slightly dull. Everybody has a clever comeback. It's unbelievable.
Very saucy. Yes, yes, yes. And it gets a little
makes
tiring.
Me nervous. Can you imagine living in a world like that?
Well, no, I can't. And I wouldn't want to. It's a little bit tiresome. I think that it's been forgotten that there are sources of humor that go back long, long, long years, and they derive from the human condition.
Although the Greeks did write plays which had poop jokes and all of that as well.
So. Yes, but I don't think they had every joke. I don't think every joke was it. Was it
now,
Aristophanes?
Well, he. In fact, he was talking about the flies. Well, that's a whole other matter.
Yeah.
You wound up working with Joseph Papp not long after you came to New York from Memphis. So
instantly,
you probably
the same week
how old
I
were
met
you then?
John Wallowich, I met Joe Papp.
So you were just a child.
And I was a kid in my early 20s, and it was probably unwise of me to leave his mentorship, which he certainly intended for me, and go over and audition for Richard Rodgers. I just thought my destiny was singing. And, of course, I had a little voice, a little light soprano voice, and at that time, Hair was on Broadway, and nobody but Mr. Rodgers wanted to employ me, so shoulda, coulda, woulda is pointless, but I would have done better to have stayed with Joe. Michael Moriarty and I made our debuts together for him in Winter's Tale in Central Park.
So you started with Shakespeare.
Yes.
And then you went to, well, not that Richard Rodgers is a come down. He was great.
The now defunct, the very shortly defunct Music Theater of Lincoln Center, and I worked two seasons there, but I was understudying there, and it was different, you know. I didn't become a well-known personage.
In fact, was it a struggle?
No, it was great fun. I larked around. I had a great time in my 20s. I give advice to girls in their 20s now, and the advice is this. Stop worrying about the world condition. Find yourself a boy with a convertible car. Put on a string of pearls and ride.
It's that kind of attitude that got you in trouble with Joe Papp. He thought that you weren't serious enough.
I'm afraid so.
But he still put you in five plays, so he must
later on, after I had married my first husband, Arthur Carter, and we had parted. I had my two little girls, and I went to Mr. Papp, and he put me back to work. He put me through some very hard circumstances because he believed that I was a wealthy young dilettante matron, and he forced me to prove that I was serious, and I think I proved it to his satisfaction, so we became friends.
But you did have the advantage of not having to worry about paying the rent. Some actors do.
At that time. Later, I was to have to worry considerably about those matters, which is why I tracked off to California at 40 years of age.
Mm-hmm. You had to get. Well, you were doing some TV here, right?
I did one series here. I did one series for David Susskind called On Our Own.
And weren't you also in a soap?
Yes. Huh. I love the soap operas. Yes, I was hired by The Edge of Night. Their last two live shows I played. And that was hair-raising, and then they went to tape, and I worked there for 2.5 years.
Mm-hmm. This book is not really an autobiography. It's not a memoir.
No, let's just make sure that we say that. This Trying to Get to Heaven is not an autobiography.
You call it Opinions of a Tennessee Talker. So it's a little bit, there is some of your life in it, but it's
there
just
are,
your opinions?
There are stories, the same kinds of stories that I tell in my show at the Carlisle that reinforce the opinions I hold now. My opinions may or may not coincide with my readers, my reader whom I call Dear Reader, with great gratitude for plonking out $22, believing that what I've written might be entertaining. Whether or not my opinions concur with yours, they do derive from my life's experience. They do not come from what I've been told I need to think by somebody on television or somebody writing for the glossy magazines. Mm-hmm. I believe what I believe because life has taught me these things. And I'm proud of my book. It comes from my heart. I did not have a co-writer. I had a clause with Simon and Schuster that said they were allowed to put somebody on the book. And after the first 40 pages came in, Marilyn Abraham, who was the editor there, assigned to me, said, we won't need to have anyone help you. You have a voice as a writer, and you must write many books, Dixie. And so I was very thrilled.
Unlike Joan Collins, they were happy with your manuscript. Do you see yourself as a typical Southern belle? You were a valedictorian in high school, won the mathematics award, and yet I get the feeling from what I've read here that you've always been forced to keep your intelligence a little under wraps.
Well, I don't think forced is the right word, and I'm scared a little bit of the nomer Southern belle because there are so many professional Southern belles out there who lean on that. Mm-hmm. I'm so proud to be a woman who was brought up in the South. Southern women do understand that it isn't all that intelligent, in fact, to brunt about one's intelligence. The wisest person, the person who really knows, is the person who doesn't have to scream, I know more than you do, I know more than you do, and now I'm going to top your story. And also, it isn't very alluring, and let's face it, I still think that the chemistry between men and women is very important, and that women who understand that know that men like to hear themselves talk. So we Southern women know how to listen. We learn how to listen. And men to whom we are attracted find out in other more subtle ways that we've got a grain or two of sense.
So you think Northern women don't know how to listen enough?
Some do, some don't. But I think it's, I was always told that that was Richard Burton's great charm, was his ability. And my husband, Hal Holbrook, is an intense and wonderful listener. And let me tell you, it does something.
I think good actors are listeners, don't you?
Good actors are reactors.
Because you can always spot a bad actor. It looks like he or she is thinking about the next line instead of listening to what the other person is saying.
You're so right. And the same holds true in conversation. You know when you're talking to somebody who just, their eyes are blank, they just can't wait to get on to the next thing that they're going to tell you, which is how much taller their mountain was that they climbed.
Well, I can't wait to get to the inconsistencies. you talk about beauty coming from within, and you even tell people they should wear good underwear so that they can feel good about themselves. And then you have a whole chapter on the subject of your facelift.
Who said consistency is the hobgoblin of the small mind? Mm. Somebody said that. Oh, and if they didn't, they should have.
But you were very aware when you were writing those different things about beauty being from
within,
that you were being inconsistent. Yeah.
Yes. We give a lot of lip service to beauty coming from the inside.
In your business,
Heaven
we understand why
true.
People have facelifts. I mean, obviously,
yeah,
it's a career decision, isn't it?
Nobody talks about it. Yeah, it's a career decision. And then there are some women who just want to keep that flesh up on the bone a little bit tighter than nature is going to let it stay, you know? I find nothing wrong with that. My sister and my sister-in-law, both of whom have had those lucky, wonderful, long-lasting marriages, have never lifted their face. They've never seen any reason to. Mm-hmm. They're quite beautiful, and their husbands think so. I lifted my face for professional reasons, and if I were absolutely true, I'm not sure But that's the only reason. I'm not sure, but I know I had to do it because I looked around me on Designing Women. I was 10 years older than the person closest to me in age, and I didn't want to be known as the older one, the oldest one.
Well, you also didn't, on the other hand, want to look like, as you said, somebody with 45-year-old eyes looking out of a 25-year-old face.
No.
You wanted your facelift to look
that's
natural.
That's a little weird. I wanted it to look natural, and now it's way past the point where you're supposed to get it done again. And I like the way I look now, so...
You don't look like you need one anyway.
Thank you. Oh, thank you, dear sir. But I think I look good.
Now, let's talk about the yoga. You haven't always been interested in yoga. You were actually driven to it by arthritis?
Because I didn't realize it was going to help my arthritis. I was driven to it because I'm in television, and I couldn't get away forever with not doing any exercise. I couldn't stand it. So a friend of mine recommended yoga, and I got onto it, and I learned that the side effect, besides pulling my waistline in again to the tiny little waist that I used to have, I discovered that the pain, which I was experiencing then from arthritis, began to diminish. I've been doing yoga about 7 years now.
And yoga is quite different from what we get from Jane Fonda and some of those other tapes. Those are real workout tapes.
Yes. Well, you can use my
tapes. You call yours an unworkout tape.
You can sweat. If you want to, using my tape, or you can relax with it. You can do whatever you want to. You can certainly tone. And I know a lot of people who do yoga whose muscles are just as buff or cut or whatever word you want to use as anybody who goes to any gym. It's just that the end result of a yoga body is going to be a longer, smoother, leaner muscle. And I don't tremble anymore on stage because of the deep breathing that yoga teaches you. And I sleep longer and sweeter dreams through the use of yoga. And I'm overall healthier and have a higher energy level because yoga teaches you how to pull that oxygen all the way down to your fingers and your toes and get rid of toxins in your body.
Now, where do you want to go? Obviously, you don't want to become a workout tape person. You want to write.
I'd like to write another book. You all, please.
The acting is the most important in the singing.
Come to see me at Rockefeller Center right after I close. I'm going to be signing books there on the.
Yeah, let me tell people.
20th,
you'll be signing
I think.
Books at Barnes and Noble at Lincoln Center on Monday the 18th.
Oh, it's
at
Lincoln, not Rockefeller.
You see?
Lincoln Center. Thank you, dear.
Lenny. Barnes and Noble, Lincoln Center on the 18th at 7:30, and then on Wednesday the 20th at the Pajama Bookshop at 723 7th Avenue. That's at 5 p.m. And you'll also be in a. You just did a mini series, right?
I did a mini series.
Gone in the Night?
Yeah.
Shannon Doherty, the infamous Shannon Doherty.
The infamous Shannon Doherty, of all things. You know, she was quite professional. I enjoyed working with her and with Kevin Dillon. But Shannon, of course, is a big surprise because she'd. And Ed Asner's a wonderful actor. But Shannon was the surprise because she's a Southern girl. She's from Memphis, and we got along splendidly. I want to impress upon you that I am out trying to sell my book, Trying to Get to Heaven. It is written for anyone who is somebody's daughter, somebody's son, somebody's wife, somebody's brother, somebody's uncle, somebody's niece, somebody's aunt. It is written as a thank you letter to my family. It is rife with opinion from what you should be wearing to how to fix your hair to what to eat to stay slim. But mostly it has to do with my encouraging my fellow human beings, whom I consider my soulmates and my fellow pilgrims on the way to a more beautiful existence in this world and the next, to encourage this person to think a little more highly of him or herself, Leonard.
Do you think you're going to get to heaven?
Yeah, because I know I'm going to, because I know I'm going to see my mother again.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you're going to write, you're going to appear in dramas, maybe even a comedy again, although I suspect
yes, I get invitations to appear here in New York on stage, and when I figure out how I can move my whole crowd, my father who lives with us, and my dogs, and everyone back east, I'm going to do it.
Well, being married to an actor who moves around must...
He's coming to New York in Death of a Salesman this fall, Leonard. You've got to see
great.
You've got to see it.
And I hope he comes on the show. Dixie Carter's book is called Trying to Get to Heaven, Opinions of a Tennessee Talker. It's published by Simon & Schuster. You can see her at the Carlisle
through this Saturday.
And thank you so much for being on New York
Thank
Comedy
you
today.
For having me.